Matthew 26 is where we are in verse 46. Matthew 26 and verse 46. We talked about that Christ had Gethsemane separated to itself. He did his duty. He did what he was supposed to do. We have, if you go to John, you have 13 is the Passover, washing his disciples' feet, instituting the Lord's Supper. And then you have 14, 15, 16, and 17, all excellent discourse, just incredible, important teaching that we are so blessed to have through that time. All this time, they are in the upper room, then they are walking towards Gethsemane and entering into the garden there. Jesus deals with this great sorrow and challenge, conquers it before God on his knees. And now he says in verse 46, "Rise up, let us be going." He could have easily avoided arrest if he knew it was coming. They could have gone somewhere else that night. They didn't have to go to the normal place. He went to the normal place, knowing that that's where Judas would come. So they rose up to be going to confront the situation. Once you've been alone with God and you have sought the Lord and you have gained his strength and you have sufficiently prepared, you can rise up and confront whatever situation comes your way. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy. This was not easy. There were great drops of blood, sweat, because of this. To overcome his natural resistance to suffering in the will of God, he had to pray. He was a man. When he stubbed his toe, it hurt just like when you stub your toe. He knew that he wasn't going to be exempted from pain. He wasn't going to be exempted from the pain of mocking, the pain of buffeting, the pain of crucifixion. All of that he felt keenly. And there was a natural, normal resistance to that which he dealt with in the garden. He had to overcome his natural willingness to resist unto blood. None of us want to do that. It would not be normal if we wanted to shed blood. If we wanted to be crucified, we would be deranged. No, he didn't want to. He said, "Not as I will, but as thou wilt." If it be possible, if there's some other way to accomplish this, then let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt. Are you willing to leave your case with God and suffer injustice without malice? All of that requires Gethsemane, amen? Mm. Verse 47, "And while he yet spake, lo, Judas, one of the 12, came, and with him a great multitude with swords and staves." Obviously, here's a great multitude with swords and staves and torches and so forth coming up through the dark. And even at this point, because it was dark, they could have probably scattered. But these men were from the chief priests and elders of the people. This was not just a band of robbers. They had authority of the chief priests and elders, but they were still working evil. They were not working according to God's law. They were not working according to just actions. It would have been permissible for them all to flee and escape, just like they did so many other times when the Jews tried to take them, and in Nazareth when they wanted to throw them down a hill. It would have been perfectly permissible to resist and flee, and that would have involved maybe some fighting if someone tried to grab you. In this situation, most likely it was Mark. They grabbed him, and he wiggled out of his coat and fled without his garment. That was resisting. And so, obviously, when you know that there's people coming against you with malice and injustice, it's very permissible to flee and to resist. Jesus chose not to do so. He gives his disciples the reasons why he chose not to do so. And this is the reason, this is what caused Peter to be thrown into consternation and frustration, because Peter had it all imagined in his mind, like so many of us do, what we would do if such and such happened. If they tried to come and grab Jesus, he already knew what he was going to do. And he felt perfectly justified in doing it, because the law of God would not have condemned him. Verse 48. Now he that betrayed him gave them a sign, saying, "Whomsoever I shall kiss, the same is he. Hold him fast." And forthwith he came to Jesus and said, "Hail, Master," and kissed him. Judas has made betrayal with a kiss the very concept notorious and well known. We all look upon this as the lowest act of treachery, the lowest of the low, to betray a friend with a kiss, to betray someone to death with a kiss. We all look upon that as dirty and cheap. How many times do people do that very thing to God? They're brothers and sisters. You come to church and you talk sweet and kind and greet with a kiss or a hug or a handshake, only to go home and chew them up and slander and criticize. You sing to God on Sunday and kiss his enemies during the week. James 4:4 says, "Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God." Anyone who comes to church and sings, you know, "Channels Only," "How Great Thou Art," "Redeemed," "How I Love to Proclaim," "How I Love Jesus," "Oh, How I Love Jesus," and then you go out in the world and you kiss up to the world and you talk their talk and you follow their ideology and you partake of their dainties, are you not doing what Judas did? Are you not then in James' category, where he says, "Ye adulterers and adulteresses"? It is that way. Mm-hmm. We need to just accept it, own it. That's what it is.
Right.
That's what it is. Verse 50. And Jesus said unto him, "Friend, wherefore art thou come?" Then came they and laid hands on Jesus and took him. And behold, one of them which were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword and struck a servant of the high priest and smote off his ear. Then said Jesus unto him, Put up again thy sword into his place. For all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. Okay, we're going to talk about this for a minute. There's a lot of assumption and foolishness built around this one little phrase in the Bible that is not in any of the other gospel accounts. The other gospel writers didn't feel it was that important to include, and they actually interpreted it. They actually believe, no doubt, that they gave the gist of what was said and the gist of what happened there in their own words, and it doesn't come out the same. So let's talk about it. All that take the sword shall perish with the sword. If Jesus was saying, in this situation, if you take the sword, you're going to die with the sword, because we have a whole multitude of swords and staves, right? Understand, Peter was no coward. Okay? A lot of people try to paint Peter up as a coward because he denied the Lord. Peter was no coward. Peter saw this whole multitude, and they were coming to get Jesus. He realized what was happening. One man drew a sword, knowing that there was only two swords in this whole group. He had one. He drew that sword. He was going to fight that entire mob, knowing that he would probably fight to the death to deliver Jesus. He was no coward. Okay? He didn't wait to see whether he was going to be able to get away or not. No, he confronted it with his sword and started hacking. He was not a coward. The problem was, he was thrown into confusion, and that'll make a coward of all of us when you don't know what to do and you're frustrated and you don't know how to deal with this because you're totally unprepared. That makes a problem. But let me ask you this. Perishing with the sword, was that not better than being crucified? I'd rather be stabbed or fight to the death with a sword and die by the sword than be nailed to a cross and be crucified. Okay? There are wackos today who want to die, and they have it's becoming more and more common. It's called suicide by police. You have a get a shootout with the police and you die by a bullet, and they call it suicide by police. And there's a lot of wackos that get on drugs and do that kind of stuff these days. Our society is becoming more lawless and wacko all the time, thanks to the ideology being presented to our society in the schools, universities, all the garbage being taught. Jesus had planned to be arrested and for all of them to escape, and that is what happened. That's what he planned to happen, and that is what happened. He said, if you want me, let these go their way. He wanted them to run. He wanted them to escape. He did not want them to defend him, though I must say I don't believe Peter's defending the Lord in this situation was breaking God's law in any way. What about Peter's sword? The pacifist churches make a big to-do about this. I've read where they say, yeah, well, that, you know, in the Old Testament it was right to fight, but Jesus took Peter's sword away, and therefore that's not the same anymore. Like, have you ever read your Bible? Jesus never took the sword away from Peter. He told him to put it back in the sheath. That means it's ready to be used again. Jesus told him not too long before this, okay, sell your garment and buy a sword because of upcoming troubles. After 3.5 years of personal training from Jesus, Peter, on Passover night, is wearing a sword and intends to use it for self-defense and the protection of the innocent. And he knew that was perfectly in line with God's law. There was nothing unholy or unchristlike about that, and Peter knew it. In Proverbs 24:11, if thou forbear to deliver them that are drawn unto death and those that are ready to be slain, if thou sayest, behold, we knew it not, doth not he that pondereth the heart consider it, and he that keepeth thy soul, doth he not know it? And shall not he render to every man according to his work? If you forbear to defend the innocent blood, God's going to hold you accountable. Peter knew that. Peter intended to fight to the death. Now, we know in Luke 22:35, just prior to this, Jesus said unto them, when I sent you without a purse and scrip and shoes, lacked ye anything? And they said, nothing. Then said he unto them, but now, obviously when you travel, when I sent you, he said, but now when you travel, same context, he that hath a purse, let him take it. Take it where? When you go out preaching. When I sent you, that's the same context, when you go out preaching. He that hath a purse, or what we would later be called a wallet, that men would carry. It wasn't a little thing they stuck in their pocket. They didn't have a pocket. And they didn't have a billfold. They didn't have bills, okay? So they had a wallet, like a purse that they would take. And it was not a womanly thing. It was like a backpack we would use today or something like that. Let him take it. And likewise his scrip. And he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. Obviously, he's not referring to that very night. It was instruction for future preparedness as they traveled and preached. That was the context. When I sent you, did you lack anything? No. Now, when you go out, take this, take this, take this. Now, obviously they couldn't sell a garment and buy a sword at midnight on Passover. How many of you believe, based on Luke 22:35, that when the apostles went out preaching after this, they carried their purse? Raise your hand. How many of you believe they took a purse? Okay. How many of you believe that, according to this, that when the apostles went out preaching after this, they took their script? Yep. Right. Okay. How many of you believe, based on this, that when the apostles went out preaching after this, they carried a sword?
Yep.
Why would the one be different than the other? Only because of false doctrine, okay? False doctrine makes us want to shy away from the apostles carrying swords. Oh, my. Oh, would that be Christ-like? Well, when he told them to, why would you think that they were carrying swords before he told them to, And they wouldn't carry him after he told them to. Peter had a sword. It was his sword. He carried it. He wouldn't have had it in the upper room if he had not been carrying it. All right? He was the head apostle. Jesus made him the head apostle. And so there's no need to shy away from this as though it's some hair-splitting, uncertain controversy.
Right.
It's plain as day.
Yep.
Now, let's go on. In Mark 14:47, in this same event, it says, "And one of them drew a sword and smote a servant of the high priest and cut off his ear." And then it goes on to the narrative and doesn't say anything more about the situation. Nothing more said about the situation in Mark's gospel. In Luke's gospel, "And when they which were about him saw what would follow, they said unto him, Lord, shall we smite with the sword? And one of them smote the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. Jesus answered and said, Suffer ye thus far," stop. "And he touched his ear and healed him." Nothing else is said on the subject. In John, "Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and smote the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus." You know how John, later into the first century, gives us names and the other apostles don't give us direct names in the Gospels? There's reasons for that. We talked about that with the Mary situation. All right? Understand that John is writing 50, 60 years after the fact. And so he feels perfectly fine in giving all the names because there's no danger now in that situation. "Then said Jesus to Peter, Put up thy sword into the sheath. The cup which my Father hath given me, shall I not drink it?" And nothing else is said on the subject. If what Matthew includes here was such a diverse, different doctrine than what they are saying, then they're not giving us something that's very important to the New Testament. But what they gave us, they believe, was enough and consistent with what Matthew shared. Scholars who try to decide which gospel was written first are divided, but they all agree it was either Mark or Matthew. And then yet Luke and John don't add that, knowing what Mark and Matthew had already added or put in there. So what we've got here, "For all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword." What did Jesus mean? Well, there's two possibilities, and they might both be true. Number one, "For all they that take the sword in this situation shall perish with the sword." Yes, that was true. It would have been likely the case had they stayed there and fought against this whole mob with swords and staves. Jesus wanted them to flee. So he said, "Stop. This is God's will for me," basically. If applied to every person in every situation, it is simply not true.
Right.
Abraham had 318 trained servants. He went out and delivered Lot and slew Chedorlaomer and his comrades, and he didn't die by the sword. Jacob in Genesis 48:22 is giving his sons their inheritance and blessing them, and he tells them that he gave Joseph one portion above his brethren, which he took out of the hands of the Amorites with his sword, okay, and his bow. Jacob didn't die by the sword. Moses slew Sihon and Og's kingdoms, wiped out their kingdoms. He didn't die by the sword. Joshua conquered Canaan with the sword. He didn't die by the sword. Gideon conquered the Midianites with the sword, and he didn't die by the sword. Levi, Samuel, David all used the sword. They didn't die by the sword. Not one of them. Okay, so the only other way this could be true is as a proverbial statement, simply as a warning to Peter, this is not the time, stop, it's not appropriate right now, because this is God's will. And it would be similar to other Jewish statements, "He that diggeth the pit shall fall therein. He that rolleth the stone, it shall return upon him." Those statements are not true except in God's courtroom. They are true in God's courtroom when you have done something contrary to God's will, against God's ways, inappropriately, you're going to reap what you sowed. It's going to come back on you. Every man shall reap what he sows. We all say, well, that's true. It's not true, except in God's courtroom. Have you ever had a garden? Did you reap everything you sowed? No. Gardening would be wonderful if you only reaped what you sowed. And you did indeed reap everything you sowed. There's a lot of sowing where there's not reaping because of a bug. There's a lot of not sowing where you're reaping weeds. You didn't sow those weeds. You didn't plant those weeds. You plant weeds in your garden, Brother Jesse? No. How'd they get there? You reaping what you sowed? No. You're reaping something you didn't sow. Right? That only applies as a proverbial statement in God's courtroom. And God will see to it. In fact, in Calvinism, nobody reaped what they sowed because nobody even sowed anything of their own volition. God predestined it, so God sowed it. God sowed it, and he made you reap it, but you're really not an entity. You're not an entity at all. You're just a puppet because predestination's a mess. But there's no sowing and reaping in predestination except God's doing it all. So we have often said that Peter was wrong because he was drawing the sword against lawful authority. Now, there is some truth to that. Paul, even when he's in court and he rebukes the high priest, backs up and retracts his statement because he realizes he's the high priest. And the Bible says, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people. It is very important that we're careful when we're dealing with government and authority. However, when you know that the authority is acting unlawfully, in malice against innocent blood, must you submit to criminal activity just because of authority that they, an office they fill? If so, then it's wrong to flee too, right? These men were not conspiring to assassinate their rulers, the chief priests and the scribes and the Sanhedrin. They were not conspiring to assassinate their rulers. They were simply protecting Jesus from what they knew to be injustice and malice contrary to God's law. So, would you allow the ungodly Biden regime to indoctrinate your children? Well, their authority, well, that only goes so far. It only goes so far. You're not going to take my children and start teaching them your wokeism,
right,
your transgender garbage, and all the ideological stupidity and rebellion against God that we see in the present regime. No, there are limits, right? It's right to protect our family even from government if we know that they are acting unlawfully, contrary to God's law, contrary to the Constitution, contrary to natural law, what we would call it, which goes back to God's law. They believed that Jesus was the rightful king of Israel, and they knew the Jews wanted to murder him out of envy and spite and malice. So they knew that this wasn't just a legal transaction. Would you allow our government to come and force your daughters into their military along with all the transgenders? Would you allow our government to force your daughters to go to the university where they've got all the transgenders and all the lies they're telling and all the garbage they're teaching? No. No. And you would not be wrong in resisting. So, the issue here is not so much, as we have kind of said in the past, that, well, Peter, well, they were authorities, so Peter, no. There's more to it than that. Mm-hmm. Okay? The problem, or the issue was, it was God's will for Jesus to be apprehended and for them to flee and not be arrested, and Jesus basically told them so. All the other Gospels leave out the statement that Matthew gave, but what they say, what you can interpret all the other Gospels as basically saying is Jesus said, stop, put your sword away, this is God's will. Don't you think I can pray to my Father and he'll send angels to deliver me? But how then shall the scripture be fulfilled? So basically Jesus says, stop, suffer it to be so, suffering you thus far, stop, put your sword away, This is God's will for me right now. Is it any wonder that Peter was left thrown into confusion and consternation? And not only so, but now he's very vulnerable because he pulled his sword and cut off the servant of the high priest's ear and in front of everybody. Everybody saw it that was right there, okay? Jesus basically said to them, "Do you not realize I am allowing this for a reason? The reason is the fulfillment of the scriptures concerning me." And therefore, he told Peter, stop. And basically, after he said this, they took Jesus and everyone, the disciples fled. They fled. Well, that's what Jesus wanted to happen. We're on verse 55, or verse 52, I guess. Then said Jesus unto him, "Put up again thy sword into his place, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. Thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then shall the scripture be fulfilled, that thus it must be?" Okay? So obviously, stop. I'm allowing this to happen for a reason. Put your sword away. And so then they fled. At the same hour said Jesus to the multitudes, verse 55, "Are you come out as against a thief with swords and staves for to take me? I sat daily with you teaching in the temple, and you laid no hold on me. But this was done, that the scripture of the prophets might be fulfilled. Then all the disciples forsook him and fled." It would be hard to know what else to do in such a situation unless you just allowed yourself to be apprehended with Jesus. That was totally contrary to their plans. And so Peter fled, and then he followed afar off. Verse 57, "And they that laid hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest." Now we find out from John that they led him to Annas' place first, maybe just to alert him to what had happened, or to show him what they had, and then they went to Caiaphas' place where the scribes and the elders were assembled. But the scribes and the elders, we find, did not get assembled for a Sanhedrin court until morning. And they held Jesus there through the night. And it says in Luke 22:63, "And the men that held Jesus mocked him and smote him. And when they had blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, Prophesy, who is it that smote thee? And many other things blasphemously spake they against him." And Mark adds that the servants smote him with the palms of their hands. Then in Luke 22:66, it says, "As soon as it was day, the elders of the people and the chief priests and the scribes came together and led him into their council." So he was kept probably in the basement or somewhere in Caiaphas' palace, the palace of the high priest, until the Sanhedrin was assembled. But he was being mocked and abused by those who held him, the soldiers and the servants, until he was brought into court. The Sanhedrin was composed of the elders, scribes, and chief priests. The scribes primarily were Pharisees. The chief priests were primarily Sadducees. And all three groups were at this meeting. And A.T. Robertson says that the Pharisees and the Sadducees would have been nearly equally represented. I'm not sure where he got that, but it's possible. Mark says, "And straightway in the morning, the chief priests held a consultation." And so it was early that morning because they were getting Pilate out of bed about 6 o'clock. So they had had their very early morning trial, Sanhedrin. And it's obvious that Annas and Caiaphas were behind it, trying to convince the whole group that this was actually a true trial. Why would they bother trying to get witnesses if they weren't trying to convince everybody that they were doing things justly? Verse 58, "But Peter followed him afar off unto the high priest's palace and went in and sat with the servants to see the end." The other disciples, except for John, didn't even do that. But John fills in the blanks. He says that Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple, which was John. That disciple was known unto the high priest and went in with Jesus into the palace of the high priest. John didn't feel as vulnerable as Peter would have felt. He was known unto the high priest. There was some family relation there, or they knew each other. He did not feel endangered in the same way that Peter did. And he went on in, and then it says, Peter stood at the door without. Then went out that other disciple, which was known unto the high priest, and spake unto her that kept the door, and brought in Peter. This was his first denial. Then saith the damsel that kept the door unto Peter, Art not thou also one of this man's disciples? He saith, I am not. The other denials came later, but that was his first step in the wrong direction. Peter was full of frustration and consternation. Peter was probably the oldest. Jesus was only 33 years old. Likely, Peter was older than Jesus. He loved him as a Messiah. He probably felt some big brotherly responsibility when he was with Jesus to protect him. And he probably feels very frustrated that he was going to fight to the death. He was going to fight this mob and die fighting for Jesus. And Jesus rebuked him and told him, put your sword up. This is God's will right now. It totally blew everything in his mind about what to do in this situation. So he fled with the rest of them, which was not in his blood. He didn't want to do that. He didn't know what else to do at the moment. He didn't want to get caught by this mob. He couldn't understand why Jesus was allowing this to happen. And so then he's following afar off. He wants to see what's going to happen. He's still concerned. He's not just going to run off and forget it and just protect himself. So instead of having a strategic position in the dark, in the garden with a sword, now he finds himself in a castle surrounded by soldiers and very vulnerable. Verse 59. Now the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Yea, though many false witnesses came, yet they found none. At the last came two false witnesses and said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and build it in 3 days. Now, why does it say they found none? Obviously, they had false witnesses. Well, Mark fills us in on this. So, you know, when Matthew wrote, he expected that people would understand some basic principles about court. Mark fills us in. It says the chief priests and all the council sought for witness against Jesus to put him to death and found none, for many bear false witness against him, but their witness agreed not together. Okay? And there arose certain and bear false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands. Within 3 days I will build another made without hands. But neither so did their witness agree together. So it's not just a matter in Jewish court, it was not just a matter of having two witnesses. You had to have two witnesses cross-examined, and their stories had to line up. Well, that's just, that's right. And no one could be rightly put to death under God's law without two viable witnesses. At the mouth of two or three, it says, let every word be established. And no blood should be shed without at least two cross-examined stories line up perfectly, two witnesses. So they couldn't find two witnesses that could put it together, and they cross-examined. And so Annas and Caiaphas, though they're trying to convince the Sanhedrin, the council of the elders and the scribes and the chief priests, they're trying to convince them that this is all just and upright. They get very frustrated. And the high priest arose, verse 62, and said unto him, answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee? But Jesus held his peace. He didn't have to say anything. He could have easily said, yes, what is it that they testify against me? Have you found anybody whose stories line up? Have you found any true witnesses? No, he didn't say it because he didn't have to, but that's what his silence basically did say. And the high priest answered and said unto him, I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. I put you under oath according to God's law that you tell us what you know. Did Jesus obey this? He did. It was his own law. Leviticus 5:1. If a soul sin and hear the voice of swearing and is a witness, whether he hath seen or none of it, if he do not utter it, then he shall bear his iniquity. In other words, if someone's broken the law and you know something about it and you are called into court and you're put under oath, you have to tell what you know about this law-breaking situation or you're going to be punished by God. That was God's law. That was Christ's law. So they put him under oath by adjuring him. Adjuring and swearing were part of God's legal process. There's two times in Deuteronomy where it says, you shall fear the Lord thy God, him shalt thou serve, and to him shalt thou cleave, and swear by his name. Why? If he's your God, if he is God, and you believe he's God, then he is the just judge of the earth, and you bring him into your judgments. You bring him into your courts. And when you swear by his name, you're saying, I call God to witness. Why? Because that's the God I believe in. And so the God you believe in is the God you swear by. Jesus rebukes all the Jewish innovations and false swearing that Malachi said he would do. But swearing and adjuring are very closely related. If I am calling God to record about my testimony, I say, I swear by God. If I'm wanting to call God to record about your testimony, and I want you to speak under oath before God, I adjure you by God. I put you under oath before God. What you say is now directly before God, and you'll be judged by whether you tell the truth or not. You say, Brother Mark, won't they be judged anyways? There is a greater judgment when there is a greater understanding of the situation. And when I adjure you before God, I'm giving you a greater understanding of your judgment before God if you lie. Just like if I call God to witness, I'm putting myself under greater accountability. So, I adjure you by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus saith unto him, thou hast said. You said correct. That's just a Greek idiom for saying yes. That's true. You say, there's people who say, well, he didn't say yes, that's true. Look back up in this same chapter, Matthew 26. Look back up in verse 25. Then Judas, which betrayed him, answered and said, Master, is it I? He said unto him, thou hast said. What was he saying? You spoke correctly. Okay? That's what it means. There's no avoiding what it means when you go back in the same chapter with the same writer, with the same person speaking, and they say the same thing, and it's obvious he's telling him, yes, it's you. Notice in this situation, the Christ, the Son of God, and the Son of Man all mean the same things to this courtroom, this Sanhedrin, the rulers of the Jews. In Mark, it says this, but he held his peace and answered nothing. Again, the high priest asked him and said unto him, art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And Jesus said, I am. And ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. So in Mark says, it records it as, I am. Matthew says, thou hast said. They all understood that to mean the same thing because that's what it meant. It meant basically, yes, whether it's a Hebrew or Greek, both in both Hebrew and Greek, the idiom is, you said it, you spoke the truth. And there are extra biblical examples that I could have put in here, but we don't have time, of conversations in the rabbinical writings where they answer this same way, and the obvious means yes, okay? So it can be proven with extra biblical writings. In Luke 22, it gives us a little more detail. Art thou the Christ? Tell us. And he said unto them, if I tell you, you will not believe. And if I also ask you or interrogate you on the subject, you will not answer me. You will not honestly answer me or let me go. He said, basically, I recognize the prejudice of this court. I understand that I'm not dealing with a just situation. And then he says, hereafter shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand of the power of God. Then said they all, art thou then the Son of God? They understood Son of Man sitting on the right hand of the power of God meant he was the Son of God. Art thou then the Son of God? He said unto them, ye say that I am, which is just another way of saying you are saying the truth. You say rightly that I am. And they said, what need we any further witness? For we ourselves have heard of his own mouth. Now, where did this Son of Man come from? Well, Jesus being God and become man, he was not only the Son of God, but he was also the Son of Man. He was a man. But if you go back into Daniel 7:13, it says this: I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him, and there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom, which shall not be destroyed. So the Jews understood, even though the term Son of Man was used for God talking to Ezekiel, God talking about other men, yet there was a sense in which there was the Son of Man who was going to sit at the right hand of the Father, and that was the Son of God. That was the Messiah. And the fact that he was going to become incarnate, the Jews didn't fully understand, but Jesus obviously did. That's why he said, how? If David said, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou on my right hand till I make thine enemies thy footstool, and you're saying that the Messiah was the Son of David, how is it then in spirit does David call him Lord? And they couldn't answer him because the incarnation was something they didn't understand. I don't know what exactly they thought. I think they thought he would show up like an angel. But the fact that he grew up as a baby in Nazareth in a carpenter shop was not their idea. Back to Matthew, verse 63. I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus saith unto him, thou hast said, nevertheless I say unto you, hereafter shall you see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest rent his clothes, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. What further need we of witnesses? Behold, now ye have heard his blasphemy. What think ye? They answered and said, he is guilty of death. Now, in court, under oath before God, knowing his words would cause his death, Jesus claimed to be the Christ, the Son of God. The true Messiah making this claim was not blasphemy. If Jesus was claiming to be the Messiah but was not, then it could be considered blasphemy. Either Jesus was speaking truth or Caiaphas was speaking the truth. Either he was indeed the Son of God, the Son of the Blessed, the Son of Man who was going to sit at the right hand of the Father, the Christ, or he was a blasphemer, a deranged deceiver. There's a lot of people who like to want to find a middle ground. Oh, he was a good teacher. He was not a good teacher unless he was the Son of God, the Messiah, the Christ. Mm-hmm. In his own court, they could not find any violation of God's law. They did not condemn him because he broke the Sabbath. I was looking at Wikipedia at some of the things that were being said, and they want to say that Jesus' trial, they condemned him for breaking the Sabbath and, you know, a couple other things. It's like, no, they did not. That's not in the Word. They didn't condemn him. Him breaking the Sabbath was not a part of this. Okay? They condemned him by his own words, period. They condemned him because he claimed under oath to be the Messiah, the Son of God, and they were not of a mind to accept such a thing. Okay? Because they either had to accept it or reject it. If they reject it, he's a blasphemer. If they accept it, then they're the blasphemers. 67. Then did they spit in his face and buffeted him, and others smote him with the palms of their hands, saying, prophesy unto us, thou Christ. Who is he that smote thee? You know, that's all going to be replayed on Judgment Day. Can you imagine? On Judgment Day, and you were one of those servants, you were one of those soldiers, you were one of those Sanhedrin elders or scribes or chief priests. You're going to know, I'm in big trouble. You're going to know what you've done. Verse 69, now Peter sat without in the palace, and a damsel came unto him, saying, thou was with Jesus of Galilee. But he denied before them all, saying, I know not what thou sayest. Now Peter has fallen back on survival mode. Natural man survival mode. I don't want these crazy little maids are trying to blow my cover. I'm in here under incognito, okay? I'm in here, I want to see what's going on, but I don't want some loudmouth maid blowing my cover before the soldiers. Can you imagine how frustrating that would be? Shut up. Won't you be quiet? His life, I mean, he sees what's going on here. He doesn't want to be arrested and crucified. He wanted to fight back in the garden. That got stopped. He's probably very frustrated at the situation, okay? And then you've got, first of all, these two maids, one at the door. And when he was gone out into the porch, another maid saw him and said unto him, unto them that were there, this fellow was also with Jesus of Nazareth. Why did he have to be a maid? You know, the frustrating part about all this. He left where he was, went out into the porch, and there's another big mouth maid out here. And again, he denied with an oath. We don't know what that oath was. You know, by the temple, by the stars, by the moon, I don't know what it was. I doubt he was saying, I call God to record. I think he avoided that. Jews knew how to do that. I know not the man. And after a while came unto him they that stood by and said to Peter, surely thou also art one of them, for thy speech bewrayeth or betrayeth thee. Then began he to curse and to swear, saying, I know not the man, and immediately the cock crew. Now, to curse and to swear does not mean he began to cuss. It's not what that means.
Right.
Okay? He began to affirm by ways of Jewish swearing. Okay? The curse idea was, let a tree fall on me if I'm telling you a lie. Something like that. Calling down a judgment upon himself to get them to believe his word. Okay? He wasn't cursing somebody else. It was bringing a curse down upon himself, which a positive affirmation, I swear by the temple, and the Jews had found ways to swear whereby it would not be really important or real binding, just, you know, it would be a minor thing, but they could still get out of a tight spot, okay? But I could almost guarantee he's not calling God to record at this time. He's using some of the tactics the Jews themselves acknowledged to try and get out of a tight spot. And nevertheless, he's denying his Lord. And it says, Peter remembered the word of Jesus, which he said unto him, before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. And he went out and wept bitterly. Luke fills in some detail here, okay? And Peter said, man, I know not what thou sayest. And immediately while he yet spake, the cock crew, and the Lord turned and looked upon Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he said unto him, before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. And Peter went out and wept bitterly. How would you work through this? How would Peter reason through this? So, Jesus told me that I was going to do this. He knew this would happen. So why is it happening? This is a setup. I've been put in this spot. I didn't want to be in this spot. I didn't ask to be in this spot. Jesus knew I was going to be in this spot, and yet here I am. I just failed miserably. I did exactly what he said I would do. But he knew it. Can you imagine wrestling with all those thoughts in your mind? If he knew this was going to happen, why didn't we all just leave the garden? Why didn't we just get out of there? I think that's what I'd be thinking about. I failed, but the reason I failed is because what I had planned, I was told no, I was rebuked, and then I come in here, I'm concerned about it, and these maids keep running their mouths, trying to blow my cover. I'm trying to be in here secret-like, and what did I do? I ended up denying that I knew him three times, just like he said. The frustration. Can you feel it? Peter, who wanted to be faithful, he planned to be faithful, even unto prison and death, has now denied his Lord to a maid. Survival mode will leave you just as frustrated and as a failure as it did Peter. Survival mode is what causes you to tell a lie because you might get in trouble if you don't. You lie to your parents. Maybe your friends come up and ask you something. Well, so why didn't you go to the party? And you don't want to say, because mom and dad said I couldn't. Oh, mom and dad said you couldn't. No, she said, well, I had more important things to do, you know. Okay. There's a lot of times where survival mode, I got to save my face. I got to save my reputation. I got to save my pride. I've got to save my neck. And so we lie. Why? Why'd we lie? Because we're in survival mode. And natural man survival mode is self-preservation mode. Mm-hmm. I want to survive. I don't want to suffer. I don't want to be laughed at. I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want anybody knowing that I actually did wrong. I don't want to be embarrassed. I don't want to have to admit and face my wrong. I don't want to confess. So I'm going to preserve and save myself by lying, by cheating, by stealing. And then you get upset. Well, I wouldn't have done it had it not been for such and such. Well, that's true. You probably wouldn't have done it had you not been put in a tight spot. But the problem was, survival mode is what you fell back on instead of faithful mode. Faithful mode is a willingness to die for the truth, willingness to suffer for the truth. Survival mode is, I'm going to preserve myself regardless of the truth. So Peter's in survival mode. God has put him in a tight spot, allowed him to come into this tight spot to reveal to him deep-rooted problems in his character. Ever been there? Oh, not me. Well, you just got in survival mode, didn't you? That's a lie. You've been there. You've been there. You've been put in a tight spot. I'm not saying in the last week, but you've been there. In order to save your hide, save your neck, save your reputation, not get a spanking, whatever it was, you weren't honest, you weren't faithful. Maybe you betrayed your Lord. Maybe you betrayed your parents. Maybe you betrayed your friends. Oh, is that your church? Well, no. Oh, you know, do you believe such and such? No. If you young people were sent to public school, you'd find yourself in a lot of tight and bad situations. And at your age, it would be wrong to send you there, but you would learn what it is to be mocked, to be beat up. You would learn a little more about survival mode if you were thrust into a public school situation. And faithful mode would probably get you mocked and beat up and who knows what. Okay? That's why your parents are trying to protect you from that until you get old enough. But sooner or later, you're going to be in the world. You're going to have to own your Lord. You're going to have to own your doctrine. You're going to have to own your standards. You're going to have to own your church and your pastor and your parents. Faithful until death must take over. True survival, by the way, requires and includes Gethsemane. Without Gethsemane, you're almost certainly going to fall on survival mode. because you have not prepared to die. Gethsemane was preparation to die. Gethsemane was preparation to suffer. Gethsemane was preparation to be mocked and spit upon, to be blindfolded and slapped. Gethsemane was preparation for faithful unto death. Without Gethsemane, we will fall back on survival mode almost definitely. Jesus said, "Why sleep you? Rise and pray that you enter not into temptation." You don't fail in survival mode, because that's what will happen. And it doesn't matter. Peter could have played the blame game. He could have blamed Jesus. He could have blamed the other disciples. He could have blamed the priest. He could have blamed the maid. He could have blamed all kinds of things as why he failed. And that's what a lot of us do. He could have blamed some disorder that he had, some sickness. I'm bipolar, so yeah, that's why one minute I was, "I'll go to you." The next minute I'm denying, it's bipolar, I can't help it. Everybody's looking for something to blame. Mm-hmm. Except the fact that they're a sinner, the fact that they've got weakness in their character, the fact that they are self-preserving and proud, it's their natural man. And apart from God and Gethsemane and prayer and preparation to die, that's what you're going to exhibit. Mm-hmm. Jesus told him, "Satan wants to sift you like wheat." Oh, so it's the devil's fault. Yeah, he was involved. It was the chief priests were involved. The maids were involved. Jesus was involved. He didn't let you die by the... It would have been heroic to die by the sword in the Garden of Gethsemane. That would have been heroic just as much as anybody who died on a battlefield fighting for the right. Instead, Peter was put in a situation where he failed. The blame game does not change the fact that I failed.
Right.
The blame game does not change the... And whatever I want to... Push my problem off on, none of it changes the fact that I did what I did because I chose to do what I did, even if it was dire circumstances, even if my life was at stake, even if I was caught off guard, I still did it. And we should realize how frail our resolve really is. You can resolve to be faithful unto death. Peter had already done that. But that resolve without Gethsemane will fail. Daily we must realize that without preparing our heart and mind, putting on the armor of God, being willing to suffer and be faithful, even if we have to die, even if we're embarrassed, even if we're mocked, even if we suffer, we've got to have Gethsemane, or resolve turns into survival mode and we fail. Let's stand together. A lot of us have felt the dangers that are all around us. We see, like we talked about in Ukraine, children being ripped away from their parents and sent to another country. And we bristle, rightly so. And we decide, this is what I would do. But what if you didn't get to do that? And you found yourself in a different situation that you did not want to be in, where you felt very vulnerable. Are you ready to suffer? Are you ready to die? Without Gethsemane, we're not. I want to challenge you. I want to challenge you in your own life. Things are going good. No armies on the horizon. We can still fail our Lord. We can still betray the trust given to us, whether it be, there's so many different opportunities where we fail to do what faithfulness would do, because we don't want to suffer. We don't want to suffer loss. We don't want to be laughed at. We don't want to be labeled by the world as a fanatic, or we don't want to be looked upon as stupid. We don't want to say, you know what, I did that because of evil in my heart. It was wrong. I'm sorry. That's tough. And we're all going to fail on those issues because they're coming up. They're coming up. Unless we get alone with God and make sure that we are prepared to fall into faithful mode and not survival mode. Any thoughts before we go to prayer?
There's been a lot of times in my life where things, stress and challenges were building up, and I could feel myself feeling the survival mode, the temptation of survival mode. And when you get into that mode, you start showing itself by how you start responding to the problems. And there's been many times where, and that can build up over time. But I'm not dealing with everybody showing up to arrest somebody overnight, but just problems build up and circumstances build up, and it's looking a bit overwhelming, and you start feeling this temptation really strong. And I've been amazed how that can diffuse when you finally realize, you know what, I haven't been getting enough time in prayer. Then you go out and you just pray it all out. And it's amazing how the next day, just about anything can go wrong, and you know that you've got God watching again. You feel like you're in the right place. You know He's back in control, and you're in your place again. And the problems are just as big as they ever were. Nothing changed at all. But it's amazing how getting that taken care of and can fix it. It can make it where you can go through it. Anything could blow up right now. I know that I'm back in the right place. That was being neglected. I was getting in too big of a hurry. Things were falling behind, and all of a sudden the mountain became mine, and I couldn't handle it. I could feel it was getting more than I could handle. You will give that back to the Lord and go out there and fight just as hard, but you realize that it changes it. And makes it way more bearable, than makes faithfulness doable.
Yeah, I hope the picture I painted this morning will help people not to sit back and think that they're so much better than Peter, look down on Peter. I've heard that all my life in churches. Oh, Peter, you know. Oh, that Peter. And I've heard it from people who were a grasshopper in his sight. You know what I'm saying? Spiritually.
Right.
He towered over them spiritually, and they didn't have the spiritual discernment to know it. And that's usually the people who do the judging and the demeaning, is the ones who don't have enough spiritual discernment in their own brain to know that they're judging something much bigger than them.
Well, and there were several of them were in the garden there, but they weren't watching and praying on Jesus' lives. They were busy catching some much-needed sleep. That was because they didn't foresee the danger.
Right.
Jesus knew what was coming, and so He had no problem staying awake. They didn't see it, so it was impossible to stay awake. But then later, Peter stayed awake. But anyway, these same people who are being so hard on Peter, they also probably are not perceiving their own danger.
Right.
And they're sleeping in the same sense. But
right.
I was thinking along the line of, if there was nothing in the law that would have forbid Peter from defending Jesus, then how critical it was that they had somebody in that situation that was familiar enough with prophecy to know that, you know what, there's prophecy that deals with this situation, and it says refrain from fighting. And the amount of faith it would take in somebody to take heed to that. You know, Jesus said it, and it's like, well, do I believe? All along I've acknowledged him as my master. Do I accept his word, even though common sense would say otherwise?
Right.
There was examples of that in the Old Testament as well, when, you know, surrender and go forth to the Chaldeans. It's like, well, that goes against common sense. But no, in this situation, that's the will of God, and you better bow to it.
Right. And it wasn't wrong to fight the Chaldeans, except when God said, I want you to surrender. Right.
And I'm sure Peter felt as much or more consternation about Jesus being arrested as any of us would for our children being taken. To have a man like that who was your hero, and you knew that you believed he was God, and I mean, the feeling of, I can't let this happen. This is impossible.
But I can't do anything about it.
But I can't. He stopped me. Yeah, but I. This isn't. I.
And I'm dealing with this. Okay, I'm dealing with this. And what do I hear? Aren't you wild? I mean, it's a little maid's voice.
You know? Yeah, it's like, give me time to sort through this.
Yeah, I give me some space.
And it's very much a tactic of Satan to try to force a response in the midst of such great turmoil.
Right.
And you know, when we talk about our challenges, we're not talking about challenges of that degree. And if somebody was in here talking about how their child was just taken off to, you know, a refuge, they don't know where in the world they went, and now they are in a tight spot and about ready to be killed themselves while they're dealing with the grief of this, and now they're forced to respond and basically betray yourself right here in front of everybody, and you're still trying to, then you might be talking about somebody who can maybe understand some of this pressure.
Right.
Our challenge is trying to be good, trying not to tell a lie when it hurts, trying to you know, get a job done. Those challenges are challenges where we fail, unfortunately. But like Daddy said, that's grasshopper stuff size compared to what Peter's dealing with here.
Let's pray.